Welcome back to 20s Toolbox here on WDIY. A quick thank you to all who have tuned in since the beginning, and for anyone who's new to the show, welcome. Happy November. I have a very special episode planned for you with a very special guest. Tonight, I'm sitting down with someone who has spent his career in public service, working to improve communities and create opportunities for others. Together, we're going to explore what it means to serve, how to be a leader, how to stay grounded in your values, and why giving back can be one of the most powerful ways to grow, both personally and professionally. No matter where you're headed next, this conversation is all about finding your own way to make an impact. With that being said, I am absolutely thrilled to introduce my guest for tonight's episode. A native of Scranton, Pennsylvania, Senator Bob Casey Jr. is the eldest of eight children of former Governor Bob Casey Sr. and Ellen Harding Casey. He graduated from the College of the Holy Cross in 1982 and went on to earn his law degree from the Catholic University of America in 1988. Before entering the U.S. Senate, Mr. Casey served his home state in several key roles. From 1997 to 2005, he was Pennsylvania's Auditor General, focusing on accountability in public programs. Then from 2005 to 2007, he served as Pennsylvania's Treasurer. In 2006 was when he was elected to the U.S. Senate, where he served from 2007 until early this year in 2025, representing Pennsylvania with a focus on working families, children, disability rights, and cross-party collaboration. Throughout his career, Senator Casey has emphasized service, community, and the idea that public leadership is about lifting others and creating opportunity. He recently joined the University of Scranton as a Leahy Distinguished Fellow in Public Service, where he is aiming to inspire young people to build meaningful lives through service, which is a renewal of the values that have guided him throughout his whole life. Senator, welcome to the show. I'm so thrilled to have you here and to talk all things public service with you.
Wonderful to be here with you. Thank you. And thanks for that substantial introduction.
Yeah, of course. I'm hoping we'll get more into it tonight. Before we dive in, would you be able to share a little bit about yourself, your experience, and what you do? I know you have a very impressive career, and I covered most of it in your bio, but if you have anything else to add.
Well, thanks so much. First of all, it's good to be at the University of Scranton, to have this opportunity to be able to engage with young people about public service. And for those who want to pursue it and want some suggestions or maybe some guidance, I'm happy to mentor students. But I think it's also important for the student body and even beyond the student body, for people to hear about what public service should be, the principles that I think undergird or are the foundation of public service. So I'm grateful to have that opportunity. The position I have at the university is part-time. Most of my time is being a lawyer, again, after not having practiced law for 28 years. So it's a little different, a little bit of a transition. But I grew up here in Scranton. I was born here at was then called the Mercy Hospital on Jefferson Avenue. I grew up in the Green Ridge section of Scranton. Went to kindergarten at a school that's no longer there, but it was the Longfellow School. And then I went to St. Clair's School from grades 1 through 6, and then St. Paul's for 7th and 8th. So I had 8 years of education by the Immaculate Heart of Mary nuns. And they taught me and so many other people in my generation about the principles of the gospel, what it means to be a person for others. And also they taught us a lot academically in terms of the rigor of a pretty focused Catholic education. Then I went to Scranton Preparatory School, Scranton Prep as it's known, where I had the Jesuits for 4 years. And of course, that's where I think because of when you're in high school, you begin to get a sense of your own background and where you're headed and I hope kind of what your values are. That's where I learned a little bit about the importance of serving others. They encourage service of various kinds. And then when I went to Holy Cross College up in Massachusetts, that's where the Jesuits really turned it on in terms of encouraging service. And I think it's because of that background and because of the example of my parents and their their commitment to not just their faith, but also to the community. That combination of influences from my parents and the Jesuits and the Immaculate Heart of Mary nuns, I decided after finishing college to become a member of the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. I went to Philadelphia and taught fifth grade, all subjects in one classroom, and including going down to lunch with them, with the children. And then I coached the eighth grade basketball team, which was an interesting experience.
Yeah,
and then later eventually went to law school, and then as you picked up my biography from there. But I was fortunate to have had a wonderful foundation from my parents. I had two loving parents who really, until my father was much older, neither of them had health problems. And they raised eight children. I was right in the middle. We lived kind of an idyllic life in the sense that we grew up in a very secure, safe community, and we had all those educational benefits that some young people don't have, or some have parts of, but not all of it. So I was really fortunate, and one of the obligations I have, now that I'm no longer in public office, I think, is to do everything I can to encourage your generation and future generations to choose public service.
Absolutely, and that's what makes you the perfect guest for this show, because this show is all about young adults learning how to build the next chapter of their life. So thank you again for being here today. Looking back at your very impressive career, you know, from state auditor general to state treasurer and then to U.S. Senator and now here at the University of Scranton in your role, what has been maybe the most surprising lesson about leadership that you've found throughout your life?
Well, I'm not sure there was one that was surprising, but what's encouraging, I think, is that as long as I was in this business of politics and government, it's not really a business, but we sometimes refer to it in that fashion, for the better part of 30 years. I mean, I became a candidate in 1995, not 2005, 1995 until leaving in the first few days of 2025. So literally 30 years in politics, and 28 of those 30 years in public office. But what was encouraging is the commitment that people make to public service, elected public officials in both parties, the commitment they make to serve, the commitment they make to doing a good job. Contrary to what you hear, you tend to hear only the bad news about politicians, but most are honorable, most are hardworking, and most are very capable. It's the ones who are either getting in trouble or not exhibiting the kind of qualities you'd want in a public official, they seem to get all the attention, unfortunately. But that was inspiring to see people that were in public service, not just the elected official, but people that work with them. I think they're in many ways the unsung heroes of our system. People that work in municipal offices and county offices and county government and city government and township government, in boroughs and communities all across Pennsylvania, and it's true of other states. People that work in Washington for senators and House members, they work in federal agencies or work in state agencies in Harrisburg. These are people that serve the community, serve the public day in and day out, but their names are never in the newspaper or on television. Their work goes on often unheralded, but they are the ones that make government work, and they help our society by making things function. That part of public service is especially inspiring when you have the chance to work with people like that are so dedicated.
Yeah, everybody has a role to play, and
right.
Sometimes it's sad that you don't get to see all of those roles, but
right.
Everybody does have a role to play, and everybody has a purpose.
Well, I'm hoping to bring some of them to campus, meaning
yeah,
either in person or by other ways, so that students can hear about people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s who are really making a difference. I'll include some 50 and 60-year-olds, but we'll kind of spread it across the generations. But really, they should hear from and know about young people that have done really good work in government, and students may not be aware of them unless they have a chance to hear them talk about their work.
Yeah. Speaking of young adults, for young adults thinking about the next chapter of their lives, whether that's a new job, a new move, a new career, what advice would you give about really staying grounded in your purpose and your values and what you believe?
Well, I think having a foundation that's grounded in values, I think the values that the Jesuits espouse here at the university and in other Jesuit institutions are critically important, not just to the person, I think that's obvious, to, as I made reference to earlier, being a person for others, being a person who strives not just for excellence, whether it's in public service or business or otherwise, the sciences or whatever you choose for your career, not just to be excellent and to strive for excellence, but to do it in a manner that's grounded in those values of ethics and honesty and doing the right thing. I think sometimes if young people don't learn that at a rather young age, either when they're very young or before they finish higher education, it's almost too late to learn that later. I think it's critically important no matter what you do, especially if you're in government serving others. You should hold yourself to the highest ethical standards. And I don't have much toleration for people that don't hold themselves to high standards when it comes to being ethical and honest. But I think it's also true in the business world. There's nothing wrong with being aggressive, and nothing wrong with being a good promoter and a good entrepreneur and a successful business person and making a lot of money. That's great. But you should do it ethically and honestly and treat people well. Affirm the dignity of people that you work with and that you encounter. So having those values, learning those values early, is a great foundation for life itself, not just for public office.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had a couple professors here who've told me that, you know, it's great if you have expertise in an area and that helps you get a job. But most often it really comes down to your character
right. And
who you are as a person that helps you excel in life.
I think character is an important word. I'm glad you mentioned it.
In your opinion, what does public service look like in today's world, especially for young adults who may feel more drawn to something like entrepreneurship or activism or maybe nonprofits?
Well, I've been preaching about this since I started here at the university a little more than 2 months ago. And one of the points I've tried to make is that you don't necessarily have to choose one or the other. There are highly successful leaders in the business community who enter public service, maybe later in their career after they've had some time as a business leader. But even if there's someone who chooses to go into government and that kind of service, I always like to do kind of a hierarchy. The highest form of service is service that is not only where you're putting yourself of the community, but you're putting your life at risk. So obviously the men and women in the military, the men and women in law enforcement, in emergency services, those people are doing the highest level of service. Folks in government usually don't have to put their life at risk. That's rare. That happens, but it's pretty rare. But no matter what you choose, it's enriching in its own way when you're serving others. That great line from the scriptures, it is in giving that we receive. And that's literally true. When you're giving, when you're serving, you receive a lot. You have the satisfaction of knowing that you may have solved a problem for a person or for a community or for a nation, or you've advanced the cause of justice. You've brought some light to people's lives. And that's its own reward. And so I think that young people don't have to choose to enter service the minute after they graduate from the University of Scranton or any other institution. You can dive into it later. I have a lot of suggestions about it if you want to dive into it early, but I'll leave those for another day. But there are lots of ways to serve. Martin Luther King said it best. This is something that people don't often quote him about, but he said, "Everyone can be great because everyone can serve." And of course, what he meant by that was not greatness in the form that we by the definition we usually ascribe to it, greatness in terms of notoriety or fame or fortune, but the greatness that comes from having served someone else or served a community. And he, in some ways, challenged us with that line. He said, everyone can be great because everyone can serve. In other words, you don't really have any excuse for not serving. Now, people say, oh, I'm busy. I'm the CEO of this company, and I've got very few hours in my week. That's true of a lot of people, but there are still ways to serve in a community. You can work in a soup kitchen on, or do things on the weekend, or you can do it after work. So there isn't just one way to serve or one pathway. The good news is your generation has already taken up the mantle of service. Sometimes, as you know, and you've had your own experience, serving while they're in college and getting a sense of what service is all about, and then continuing it after they leave.
Yeah, I agree. And service doesn't have to be something, you know, huge or gigantic. Sometimes
right.
It's just very simple ways, like you mentioned, working in a soup kitchen.
Yeah.
Very simple thing that you can start right away today.
Yeah. Even if it's 2 hours a week.
Exactly.
People have very busy lives.
Mm-hmm.
You say, I can't do a lot. Pay 2 hours a week doing something. There are lots of ways to do it.
Switching gears a little bit, we recently had an election, and as you and many other people may have gotten, I've gotten all those, you know, remember to vote, tomorrow's election day, all those text messages. But there was one of them that really caught my eye. It said, like, it had my name in it, like, you're registered to vote in Pennsylvania. And it said, your generation is somewhat unlikely to vote. And I kind of have been reflecting over that since election day. And I wanted to ask you, what has been your experience with young people participating in elections? Do you think we're seeing high numbers of participation? And if not, what can we do to change that and get people more engaged?
Yeah, I think it's contrary to that. I can't recite all the data from recent, you know, presidential elections in terms of the turnout among young voters. But I think if you look at the period, at least for the last 15 years, I think the data would probably show that the participation by young people is up. I know that, for example, in the period after 2015, those numbers went way up. I was a candidate for re-election to the Senate in 2018, and I remember the participation of young people in that year, which was an off-year election, not a presidential year, was way up from where it was in the comparable year, which was 2014. 2014 was the last midterm for President Obama. 2018 was the first midterm for President Trump. And the increase, I'm certain of this, I don't know the exact numbers, but I'm certain the increase from 14 to 18 among young people was dramatic, almost like a hockey stick number shooting way up. So I think it's true that, and it's possible that maybe 2024 was lower than 2020 among young people. I don't know that data, but so it does ebb and flow. But I do think that my own experience, having been in politics and, you know, for, as I said, 30 years, I've seen a lot and seen a lot of elections come and go. And I have rarely seen young people more engaged than they are now. Now meaning, say, the last 10 years or so. And they've made a difference, not just in terms of their numbers being higher and having an impact at the ballot box, but in between elections, marching and mobilizing on behalf of an issue or a set of issues or on behalf of a candidate, sometimes out of frustration and even anger in a protest sense, but also sometimes in a very affirmative way because they believe in something, they believe in a candidate. So I've seen a lot of energy in the engagement by young people, and I think that will continue because young people are, I think, realizing they can make a huge difference.
Many young people may be concerned about polarization, maybe disinformation in today's society. Based on your experience, how can we maybe sort of rebuild trust in public service and institutions so younger generations feel more inspired and encouraged to participate?
Well, I think this is one of those areas where it's everybody's job. As a citizen, I can't say to the people in Washington or Harrisburg and the federal government, state government, or down the street in Lackawanna County government, I can't just say they ought to do the following. They ought to get along better. They ought to be less partisan and then not do anything in my own world, so to speak. So we all have an obligation to try to lower the temperature. And lowering the temperature doesn't mean that you don't engage in vigorous, even loud disagreement with people. But lowering the temperature and being more constructive means that you make your point on an issue or a set of issues, but you don't engage in the kind of demonization that we've seen too often. And it's not just in Washington. it's throughout society. People often disagree, and then they demonize each other, or one demonizes the other. They, what I call, categorically condemn. Not only do I disagree with you, but I think you're a bad person, and here's why. That's going too far. And all of us as citizens, and I as a public official, I was guilty of it periodically, but I tried not to. I tried to step back from the abyss, so to speak, where you can go too far in an argument. You condemn someone, you say, well, they don't believe in this, or they have this position, so therefore they're not patriotic, or they're not this, or they're not that, or they don't care about this or that. I think all of us have an obligation to do that, not to refrain from debate, not to have vigorous debates, not to shy away from confrontation, but to do it in a manner where it's governed by kind of a set of rules, that you don't try to demonize the other person. You disagree with them, and you state that disagreement clearly, and you try to back it up and let them talk. And then, so I think that's part of it in terms of how we get back to a better place. We're not in a good place as a country right now. We're having awful disagreements that lead to division, but not enough is getting done. Throughout our history, we've had people disagree, and even venomously sometimes, but usually something got done. The problem with today is it's not just discord and rancor, but it's rancor and discord that leads to dysfunction. That is intolerable, because if the system doesn't function over time, if everything breaks down, people begin to lose confidence in it. And guess what? They'll start to look for other forms of government or other ways to do things, and that's not good. We've got to make our democracy work, and part of that is the obligation of citizens and public officials to do their part. But I think young people have the capacity to lead that effort, because, as I said, young people, I don't think, have ever been more engaged because of the technology of today, including social media, which I have a lot of criticisms of, and I could catalog or itemize those for you if you wanted to. But the upside of social media is able to communicate on a more regular basis, moment to moment, instead of every 24 hours or so, with the old way of having a newspaper that people read in the morning and then waiting for the evening news to hear about something, and then the next day maybe talking about it at the office. Today, everything is immediate. People are debating in real time within seconds of an event. Mm. And that can be good and bad. But I do think that young people have the capacity, and I think I hope the willingness to help us solve problems by, having good debates, but lowering the temperature and try to get things done.
Yeah, I agree. One of my favorites from Walt Whitman, and it says, be curious, not mm-hmm. judgmental. Mm-hmm. So going back to what you said about the division that we're seeing in the world today, I think there's a radical lack of curiosity to understand
right.
people, communicating to understand, not communicating to judge. And I think I'm also encouraged by young people's willingness to kind of produce more compassion in the world.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. Part of the answer isn't simply to try not to engage in demonization and categorical condemnation. But part of it also is to affirmatively try to reach some measure of common ground. And by definition, that means standing in the shoes of the person you're debating to the extent that you can. Now, it's difficult to do that in a campaign, because it's kind of a back and forth. But in terms of just regular debate away from campaign seasons, you have to try your best to understand their perspective, or at least try to understand their perspective. If someone comes at you in an argument about an issue and they're really angry about this issue and they think you're wrong, one thing to try to do, and it's difficult in the moment when someone is screaming at you or you're engaged in a real back and forth, but try to understand why they're angry. And you shouldn't immediately say they're angry because they're a bad person, they're angry because they're obtuse, or they're angry because they're uninformed. You should try to say, okay, let's really think about why they're angry. Why do they have this passion about this issue, and then try to meet them there. There's no magic wand to this, but I do think that you have to try to get a sense of why they've arrived at that position, and see if there isn't something about that position or a portion of that that you can say, okay, I can agree with you on this part of it, but not this. Even if it's 10%. It's a start.
Yes.
I remember years ago when I got to the Senate, there were two senators among many who disagreed vigorously and were on the same committee, but who also had some areas of great bipartisanship, and I learned from that, watching them. One was Ted Kennedy. Everyone knows him. Famous senator from Massachusetts, brother of President Kennedy. He was a senator that represented the state of Wyoming. Mike Enzi, his name was. He died a couple of years ago. Now, Mike Enzi was a very conservative Republican. And I remember he and Ted Kennedy talking, or I think it was Mike Enzi talking, and he said, and then this might have been after Ted Kennedy had passed away, I think in 2009, but he said, you know, Ted Kennedy and I disagreed on 80% of the issues. He said, but we tried to make real progress on the 10% or 15 or 20% we did agree on. Unfortunately, that is not what gets the coverage and attention. It's the fighting and the conflict that gets the most, because we're not just people in the press, but I think in our society, conflict is sometimes more exciting to watch than agreement. So sometimes when there's robust agreement, it doesn't get a lot of... And that's injurious or adverse to the interests of teaching society about how people can work together.
What's next for you personally? How do you envision your next chapter, and what kind of legacy do you hope to build to encourage young people?
Well, I'm in my next chapter now. I'm a lawyer with the law firm of Dilworth Paxson based in Philadelphia, so that's keeping me really busy. And also here at the university, talking to students here about public service and trying to give the benefit of my experience to the students and in the community here at the university. It's pretty difficult for a person to say this is going to be my legacy or this is what I hope it will be. But I do hope that I can contribute now that I'm not in a public service position per se, an elected position, to inspire more young people to choose public service, either early in their career or thereafter. Because if we have more young people that choose to do public service and believe in it, that all public service is a trust given in faith and accepted in honor, which I've repeated ad nauseum here at the university, that if they choose public service and go about their work in that fashion, we'll have a better society, we'll have government that functions better, and we'll have a better community. So I hope I can contribute to that.
I would say you're well on your way.
Grace, thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. One last question for you that I've asked all my guests on the show.
Yeah.
Kind of reflecting on your career, what's the best advice you've ever received? And would you be able to share that? It could be about anything. It could be about public service or something else.
Yeah, I think the advice I received is probably from my father and really both my parents about ethics. They didn't stand up on at the kitchen table and say, here's what ethics is and here's how you should try to lead an ethical life. But I think it was probably the example of my father, not knowing when I was hearing it that I would be in public service, public office someday. But he constantly was talking to us about how to do things the right way, especially if you're an elected official, and that privilege you're given to serve in a public office has to be not just the subject of your devotion and serious hard work, but also that you have to do that ethically and honestly. He lived that. It was more his example than his preaching at us. He lived it and set the tone for not just our family, but I think a lot of people that worked with him in government. So I think it's ethics, and it's critically important we keep talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I cannot thank you enough for doing this. This has been a fantastic conversation. Do you have anything else you want to add?
No, just grateful for this opportunity because you're allowing me to talk about public service in this forum, in this format, and I hope that more and more young people in this community of the university and the wider community will choose public service.
Absolutely. I hope so, too. Well, for those listening, that's all I got for you on this month's episode. A huge thank you to Senator Bob Casey Jr. for joining us and sharing his insights on what it really means to serve, not just in government, but in everyday life. If there's one thing to take away from this conversation, it's that public service isn't limited to holding office. It's about showing up for your community, using your voice, and finding purpose in helping others. Whether you're just starting your career, changing paths, or you're figuring out what comes next, service can be a part of that journey in so many forms. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to keep listening to 20s Toolbox here on WDIY, and maybe share this episode with a friend who's looking for inspiration as they build their next chapter. Thanks for listening, and until next time, keep learning, keep growing, and keep finding ways to make a difference right where you are, right now. Thanks, everyone.